Welcome to the If Not Now, When podcast series. My guest today is Akin Oyebode from Ekiti State. He's the Commissioner of State for Finance. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Amaka. Thanks for having me.
So today we want to talk about state governance, challenges, opportunities. And as you know, I mean, we've had this conversation off camera and a lot of people have talked about this. We talk a lot about the federal government and we don't talk enough about the states. And a lot of people don't understand what the state's responsibilities are or even what the challenges are, right? So I want to start with that, with that framing. Typically in a federation, most public services are provided at a state level, whether you call it local government or not. So in many countries, it's cities, right? But things like water, sewage, primary education, primary healthcare, all of that actually in Nigeria is in the constitution as states. The states don't really do well at these, or at least we don't talk enough about it. Why? First of all, why do you think there is such a lack of awareness about the role that states should be playing in providing public services?
So thanks, Amaka. I think it starts with forms of government, right? So under what was a military government, very unitary, very centralized, very top-down, states were appendages of the federal government, right? So if you think about the head of state just appoints governors, and removes them at will. So because the governors at the time served at the pleasure of the head of states, states were just seen as outposts where, you know, military rulers, you know, appointed they were juicy offices to reward loyal junior officers. So that perspective helps to shape how we look at states.
Because the state's governors and officials weren't responsible to the people in the states, are responsible to somebody in Abuja who had appointed them.
Or in Lagos at the time.
Or in Lagos,
So, you know, you find that's one issue. Yeah. The second for me is also the heavy dependence on oil revenues, right? Which means you don't really need a social contract with the people, right? So you found that where oil revenues played a leading role in revenue generation, states really didn't have to do much. They didn't have to ensure there was a social contract with the people. And all of the focus and attention was simply on how much oil are we producing? What's the oil price today? So if you think about 1993, there was a Gulf oil windfall. That's all the country talked about. You know, nothing else mattered. So I think those two things have helped to shape how we look at, you know, the federal states relationship.
So because they're very, very good point you're making, because the idea is if you had to collect taxes from your state, you would have to provide services to justify the taxes that you're collecting.
Just to justify, if you allow me to interject, to even make the states more competitive
to even be able to collect you. Good point. So let's talk about that, right? Because a lot of states still today, even though now oil is now 6% of GDP, we're not pumping that much oil, all states are still not collecting much. And some will argue that they can't, right? So let's talk about that. What is the state of public finances in? I mean, we can look at Ekiti, for example, but if you want to talk more broadly, that's fine. How much of the state's revenue comes from FAC distributions? How much is generated internally?
So I think to talk about that properly, you know, we've got to look at states as the economic units for growth in the country, right? So I always remind people that there's painfully little outside of government happening in Abuja, right?
It's very important.
What is earned in Abuja is actually determined by what happens in the 36, you know, subnationals, right? So without the subnational, there's no federation. I think in terms of revenues, some states are obviously much better placed than others, you know, Lagos being a clear outlier. And that's just primarily some geographical advantages of being, you know, a coastal city where obviously the major ports exist and being the former administrative and business capital of the country. And so Lagos, for example, will say to you, well, most of our revenues, I think now circa 80% comes from internally generated and collected revenues, you know, 70 to 80%, I'll say. For many of us, that number still hovers between 20 and 30%, right? But it's shifting. You know, I mean, if I take my state for example, you know, we're now about 30-32%. We started 5 years ago when I started as finance commissioner. or as a mm-hmm. member of the State Executive Council, that number was closer to 12%, right? So it's grown
12% internally generated. Yes. Now you're between 20 and 30.
Now we're between 20 and 30, right? But again, you know, you've got to recognize that you need to invest, right, in a productive environment to grow those numbers.
Yeah.
Right? So that's the yeah. trade-off when people say, hey, but you should be able to collect more.
Yeah.
But hey, you need to grow. You need resources to develop the environment to build a commercial hub to allow you grow taxes.
So I want to come back to what you've done to grow it.
Correct.
In
okay.
Ekiti. But first, I want to understand, how do you think about that chicken and egg problem, right? Which is like, people say, well, I can't collect anything because there's no money here, there's no business here. Mm-hmm. So, and Nigerians will complain, well, why are you coming to tax me when you're not providing? But at the same time, you can't, like you said, you can't provide. So how should we think about it? How should Nigerians think about it? Should states be expected to do more first before they can collect more taxes, or should it be the other way around?
I think there are a bunch of different solutions that must be done at the same time.
Yeah.
So the first is, where you have limited resources, you need to be very clear and very careful about the quality of spend,
okay,
right?
Okay.
Because when we think about resources available to Nigeria as a country, we're an under-resourced country, right? So the size of government is simply too small to deliver the services needed for 200 plus people, right?
Totally agree.
So let's not have the conversation about, I mean, we can do budget comparisons yeah. with Brazil, etc.
Yeah.
There's nowhere we compare ourselves no. with where we are not significantly worse off. South Africa, Brazil, you know,
I
these
agree.
Are our peers.
Yeah.
You know, some I would even say, in terms of just the sheer size of our population, much smaller than Nigeria.
Yeah.
So that's a starting point. And of course, states being, you know, part of that story, obviously are under-resourced. So
yeah.
quality of spend, I think, is one thing that we need to do better, right?
Okay.
I think the
That's
second
fair.
Part is to say,
and why? Why is the quality of spend? Is it more about signaling, or is it about? Because I push back on that argument,
mm-hmm.
right? Because I think there's too much focus on it. So when you talk to people in Nigeria, they're always complaining about, oh, the governor has a nice car and he has a long convoy. And I always argue, I hear you on the signaling.
Mm-hmm.
But even if you removed all the governor's cars and you didn't pay the governor any money, there still won't be enough money to do anything productive in the state.
So
why is that the focus?
I think I tell people that there's a binding constraint when we start talking about those things, right?
Yeah.
Because if you take any state in the country, circa 60 to 70% of existing resources will go on servicing what is a fairly large and robust, you know, wage bill. Right.
Okay.
So wages, pensions already take
in the state,
you know, 60% of your resources anyway. So you're right about majoring in the minors, because the things that people tend to see, I'm not, of course, defending long convoys and flamboyance, etc. But they're really a rounding error when it comes to numbers. Well, what I think the real concern is, what are the things that help us lift productivity? My thesis is that you've got to have a healthy and skilled workforce, right?
Mm.
So investment in primary education and healthcare, for me, become, you know, a major issue, right? But people don't see what you might call soft infrastructure, right? So people like to see roads, people like to see buildings. So that's what we spend on, right? Because again, the cycle of elections, right, and the expectation of the populace is you must show tangible infrastructure.
Yeah.
So that's what I mean about quality of spend. How do you focus? What is your priority?
Yeah.
Because you can build great roads, but if you don't have a skilled workforce, right, you're still going to see stunted or limited development. So it's just that trade-off in terms of, you have limited resources, what do you prioritize?
So you're saying prioritize healthcare and what was the second thing you said?
Basic education.
And education. Okay.
So
you're saying, mm-hmm. instead of spreading your little resources across many different things, you'd rather focus it on one or two things and try to get results there.
I think yes. I think you've got to say, what are the must-win battles?
Yeah.
Right, and let's devote what we have today to those must-win battles.
Mm-hmm.
There are other conversations we can have about what the relationship between federal and state spend should be, right? So there are certain things today that the federal government collects and spends on that I can argue will be suboptimal if done federally, right? So if you take something like rural electrification, for example, or the tertiary education trust fund, for example, where companies pay an education tax effectively that gets administered federally, it's inequitable, right?
Yeah.
And it's also suboptimally, you know, utilized in many instances, right? Because how do you administer something like rural electrification, for example, nationally. Meanwhile, a lot of these resources are coming from multilateral funding, which is effectively loans, right? So, you know, there are certain things that we can shift in terms of what should the federal government focus on, what should be state-led, and even in terms of the revenue distribution, right? Mm-hmm. As my former boss, Kayode Fayemi, who I think has been on your podcast, mm-hmm. says, you know, we suffer from a tyranny of unfunded mandates. And it's the reality where state governments, subnationals, are responsible for a lot of their own stuff, some of the federal stuff, right? Yeah. But the revenue distribution doesn't reflect that.
All right. Yeah, so I want to come to that, but let's just linger a little bit on this issue, because I don't think we've talked enough about this. Why is it that states, like when we say that states are best placed to provide public services, mm-hmm. let's talk why. Like, does it make sense? Because it doesn't make sense to me in any world that the federal government can go and make sure that there's piping to deliver water in every house in Enugu, mm-hmm. and Ekiti, mm-hmm. and Lagos, mm-hmm. and it just cannot be done, mm-hmm. from Abuja, right? And you mm-hmm. can say the same thing for basic education, that like it's just impractical.
Correct.
So you're saying though that the distribution of resources is not even. So you would want to have more allocation from the federal away from the federal and to the states.
Well, I think so. Again, there are a bunch of different things, right? First, you know, when people say we want, and even you slipped up a bit saying more allocation from the federal, the reality of the conversation is that the resources come from economic units, which are the states.
So it's actually the states
who are giving resources to a federal government, right? Mm. Which in itself is not a productive unit as such, right?
But it's not given. I see what you're saying. I wouldn't quite put it that way. It's more that the states that the federal government is collecting is coming from the states. The revenue is coming from the
Correct.
States. Not that the states are giving it. I hear what you're saying.
But I have to start from an extreme perspective to make the point.
To make the point.
Right. So the reality of the conversation is that today, right?
That's fair.
To make those states, and you're right, you're absolutely right. You know, whether it's security, whether it's water, delivery of services, the closer you are to the people, the more effective you ought to be, right? You know, so that is where I think we need to shift, you know, the mindset to. What I see today is a careful messaging, right? Where there's a lot of focus on hold your governors to account, right?
But is there though?
No, there is. And you know, if you hear it, you know, there's always the story around, oh, governors now have more resources. Yeah. They should be able to pay minimum wage. If they can't pay, they should resign, etc. You know, which is a fine argument you can have, you know, when you sit in your house. But the reality is today, the resource allocation in the country doesn't reflect the mandate sharing between the national government and subnationals.
What do you mean by
so, that? So I'll give you a very simple example, right? At the heart of a security conversation, right, the federal government, yes, is responsible for guaranteeing the territorial integrity of the country. But if someone is kidnapped in Ekiti State, no one's going to call the president to account, right? Yeah. They're going to start with the local government chairman.
When you say no one, on Twitter, they'll call the president. But yeah, that's fine. I mean, go ahead. In practical terms, right, president can't do anything from Abuja.
The people who run the government in the state are the ones who bear the brunt of that responsibility, right? Yeah. So you call the local government, you call the state governor, right?
Yeah.
Now, but security is still on the exclusive list.
Yeah.
But in the reality, everybody funds security, right? Local government funds security, state governments fund security, individuals fund their own security, right? And the reality is that, look, if we do not, we should actually, you know, decentralize that thing properly and also let the funding follow that decentralization. I'm not saying, look,
I'll come back to that because I want to push you on that.
Sure.
Given what we've just said about how little the states are collecting, we'll come back to whether it actually makes sense for states to be funding their own, because they don't have the money. Okay, but let's come back to that.
Happy to have you.
But I want to pick back up on what you said, right? You said, look, very little money compared to our peers anywhere, mm-hmm. which means we have to prioritize. And so for you, you think basic healthcare, basic education, but there's a tension there. People want visible. How do you resolve that? How have you reconciled that tension in the sense that how do you make it politically feasible to focus on that education and healthcare when people want to see infrastructure?
So again, I think one is where you make the infrastructure investment, it has to be backed by a lot of evidence, and requires, you know, a proper thought process, right? So there's also a lot of data that goes into how we make those choices, right? So when we say we want to build roads, you know, everybody's crying for a road, but we can only build 10, right? So which 10? You know, we're saying what economic hubs are being connected? How many people are going to travel through these roads, right? What kind of commercial activity can we open up if we have this road? How much time do we save, etc.? So there are some metrics you follow to determine what roads make sense, right?
So you're saying you can't completely abandon the things that, but you still have to build a road, yeah, so that people will say, you know, and then still find a way to do the public education and that, you know, that needs to be done.
The problem is always going to be, one, how do you minimize cost, right? Yeah. Especially in today's world where, you know, inflation prices are galloping, you know, so you've got to also then marry that with how much debt you're taking. Which is not a very attractive thing in today's Nigeria. You know, it's not a very popular thing to say you have to borrow today to invest in tomorrow's future. But how else?
I always say there's two ways of raising money.
Yeah.
It's either you tax people or you borrow.
Or you borrow, right.
It has to be one or the other.
So,
yeah.
Or a combination of both.
Or a combination, yeah.
You know, I mean, and so my role, for example, in Nekit is always to say, well, I'm not going to say we'll never borrow. That's, I mean, that's crazy.
Yeah.
But we always say, how do we manage our cost of debt, right? Yeah. How are we managing cash flows? How are we ensuring that we have longer term debt and we're investing in economically productive opportunities? So if we're building a road, it's not just a social investment, but it's because we expect it to drive some commercial activity. Okay. And that commercial
not
activity...
Not just building a road.
Correct. So there has to be some economic justification behind some of those decisions.
What have you guys done to move your IGR from, you said 12% to 35% of your total budget, of your total revenue?
So it's a bunch of things. One is better revenue assurance.
What
so again, we now have systems that help us see the revenues, you know, whether it's revenues coming from our hospitals, from our tertiary institutions.
Like a TSA?
Correct.
Like a treasury single account type of stuff?
There's a TSA, which is fine. We've implemented TSA now, you know, almost a decade. But there's also the need to say, you institutions who collect funding from us, you are going to open up your systems to us, right?
Okay.
Whether or not you're autonomous, you're going to open up your systems to us. We're going to see how much you earn, right? Where necessary, we're going to collect surpluses, right? And so that helps us, it gives us better visibility on revenue, right? So we actually then know, okay, this is how much revenue we're collecting. Now we've also gone, and I think for me, the biggest thing is our internal revenue service is actually fully autonomous. Right. And so we had a chairman that was appointed through a competitive process. And that chairman and his leadership team have now also hired employees through that same competitive process. So we've sent our civil servants back into the civil service because, again, you know, the incentives don't align. Where you have civil servants whose roles tend to be permanent, right, in a job where you should be paid for performance, right?
So
there isn't
motivation.
And then you can't, you also don't have the mechanism to even reward them.
Or punish them if they don't.
I'd like to even say start with reward, right?
Because,
you know, you can't offer a carrot.
Yeah.
Then there's no reason why you offer a steak.
Yeah.
Right? So what we've done is to give that agency its autonomy. It's an autonomous body today, and we're seeing the results of that autonomy.
So that's not the case in other states?
I think
not autonomous?
Many states have now... There's autonomy on paper and there's real autonomy, right? So in this case, all our staff are externally hired, you know.
For the local, what is it called again?
For the Internal Revenue Service.
Internal Revenue Service.
So the chairman...
So he's not taking people from the civil service.
No.
He's hiring his own
Correct.
People.
Correct. And the management team can take a decision on whether or not to retain those people, right?
Okay. So that makes a big difference.
Oh, it makes a big difference because it brings a lot more productivity to the workforce, right? We've also layered that with technology, right? So now, you know, you can, for most, if not all, taxes and levies, you can pay online, right? We've made, you know, the ease of payments, the ease of assessments, you know, and the last layer which we're adding is right now we're doing the digitization and enumeration of our property units, you know, and I expect that we're going to roll out full-scale property taxes this year.
Ooh.
So again, that gives us...
So
that gives us, again, an uplift.
Yeah.
Yes, it's not...
Talk about that.
It's not the most politically correct decision.
What?
But at some point...
The autonomy?
Just even generally where people don't pay property taxes, right? But again, the reality of the conversation is that if you build a house, we put a road there, you know, we secure that place, we put drainage in there, you know, we do a lot of these channels that help to protect the value of your property.
Yeah.
Then the government deserves to tax that.
So I want to talk about personal income taxes and like mm-hmm. what role communication plays in this. But first, I also want to pick up on something else you had said earlier. 60% of the budget, mm-hmm. it goes to paying the civil service.
Correct.
And it's true that in a lot of states, it's kind of like a job program, the civil service, right? Like for, I don't know, I don't want to make you say anything politically sensitive, mm-hmm. but there are a lot of places where it's like, oh, okay, well, politician, I want a job. Oh, okay, I signed them to this civil service position.
It's not
okay.
that way, but...
So tell me why that is the case. Tell me why it is such a big part of, is there history to it? Is
yeah, there's some challenges? Legacy. There's some legacy.
Let's talk about that.
You know,
yeah.
First, remember Nigeria has been balkanized to some degree, right? So we started with, you know, regions, at some point 12 states, at some point 19, 21, 36, you know. So if you take Ekiti, for example, you know, we're I like to say the most educated people in the country. But that comes with some costs, because if you look at the old Ondo State civil service, right, a large number of those people were of Ekiti extraction. So when Ondo State was split into two states, right, it was only natural for the service there to say, all the Ekiti guys, well, go back to Ekiti State, right? So you then have Ekiti on day one,
with a bigger service than it needed,
right? And that it's very difficult to unwind that, right? Because what then happens is you start to create roles you might not necessarily need.
Is it hard to fire people?
It is hard to fire people.
Because I know El Rufai tried, and he had to like reinstate some people. Why not just fire them?
I think
cut it down.
Look, you've got to be mindful of, you know, the political implications of these decisions, right?
Yeah.
Especially in places where, and you're right that sometimes jobs are a, you know, pseudo social program, right?
Yeah.
So you find, I mean, I always use an example of someone I really, really like and respect, Chinbisi Akonde, you know, our national leader, who was, you know, a very forward-thinking governor of Osun State. And he came to the role very clear about, this is a pretty large service, we don't really need this many people, and went on a right-sizing program, right? All his opponents had to do was to say, hey, you know, this guy has fired all of you, he doesn't like you, he's anti-people, when I come in, I'm going to make sure I hire everybody else. And indeed, when his successor came into office from another party, he not only reinstated all the people, he hired additional people, right? And the political implication of that, which people don't say, is that those workers then form a big voting bloc, right? And will vote. I mean, Turkeys will vote for Christmas. So they will vote for a government that is seen to be responsive to their needs and is bringing more of their people into the civil service.
So how do you navigate that, though? Because I think this is a huge problem for Nigeria, not just at the state level, but also at the federal level. Like, you need a competent civil service, but you can't get rid of the incompetent one you have. So what's the way around it?
I think it's not as big a problem as people think it is. I think first, from a numbers perspective, I think we're underserved across different
social services. So maybe it's retraining and
fitness for purpose,
and
right?
Reassigning.
And, you know, so for example, when we say we take people out of the Internal Revenue Service, why not firing those people? We're bringing them into the civil service and we're looking at their skill sets, their profiles, and saying, okay, so where can we fit this person in? So instead of going, we haven't recruited, you know, large numbers of civil servants in years, right? Because again, some of these people were taken from one part of government, were feeding into another part of government, you know? So that way, you are retraining people, you are reassigning people, and you're focusing on what your priorities are. It's an easier way to manage those numbers.
Yeah.
As against doing radical stuff that you, in reality, practically, you will roll back.
That makes sense. Okay, now let's go back and talk about generating more IGR. You talked about property taxes, which I want to get to, but also personal income taxes. So this is something that a lot of people don't understand in Nigeria, which is most countries in the world get most of their revenue, by far most of their revenue,
from personal taxes.
From personal income taxes.
Correct.
If you look at the numbers, majority of tax revenue comes from personal income taxes.
Correct.
Nigeria is one of the only federations, I don't know of another one, where the federal government cannot tax
individuals.
Outside of Abuja.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty unique in that. But the states themselves are not doing a great job collecting personal income taxes. Why is that?
I think there's some progress happening now.
Okay.
I'm happy with some of the work, you know, the Fiscal and Tax Reform Committee is doing. Because a big issue is that the federal... Now, we've got to realize where people have comparative advantage, right? Federal government has a lot more advantage in terms of the access to data, right? Mm-hmm. Because it has access to national and international data, right? You have all sorts of tax treaties, tax collaborations. So you see, for first, the wealthiest people. You have a lot more data on the wealthiest people than states will ever have, right? So I think there's a lot more collaboration that needs to happen between the federal tax service and the state tax service. I honestly, if you asked me what my radical idea would be, I would say, look, FIRS, you collect personal taxes, leave me to deal with corporate taxes, right, as a state.
Why do you think that's politically feasible? Because to me, I do worry that the system we have doesn't make sense. I mean, first of all, even more established industrialized countries will tax you at the federal level, and they'll also tax you at the state level. But in a place where the states don't have the capacity to do it at large scale, why not just let the federal government do it?
I think I won't say the states don't have the capacity. I'll say the capacity of states is sort of constrained relative to the federal government.
Do you think that it is a politically feasible compromise to have that the governors could agree to say, you know what, federal government, you collect personal income taxes, take a fee, and give it to us, just like VAT. Because VAT goes to the states, but the federal government takes 15%.
I mean, I guess the thing is, again, that conversation about take a fee is where it gets a bit controversial, right? Because for us, for example, one of the things we say is, hey, we are the primary agents of collecting VAT, right? So when you go into states, a large chunk of the VAT that FIRS collects is VAT on government contractors, right?
So again,
these are things that I could argue that, you know, the federal tax office isn't doing anything but auditing what we remit as VAT on our contractors. So a large chunk of those things, the state revenue service, the state payment office, right, or what you might call the state treasury office, right, does a lot of work on collecting things like VAT. To pay cost of collection.
So
the point is, but I guess there's a conversation to be...
Is it politically feasible?
It's possible. Okay. And I think it's a conversation that we need to have. Look, one thing I think we can agree is that our current model isn't working, right? Once that's our starting point, then everything is on the table. It's only if it's where you are successful that your methods aren't questioned, right? If your methods have failed, then every conversation
it
is on the table.
It should be on the table.
Yeah.
Okay, what about property taxes? Is squarely... states. Not much of that is being collected today. Why?
Yeah, I think historically, again, if we raise our hands, you know, there's been a dependence on, obviously, you know,
oil revenues,
etc. And it's an easier conversation, right, not to tax people's properties, right? Because what that does is it raises awareness of a social contract, right? So if you can get by, look, I think it's partly human nature that if you can get by without, you know, arousing a lot of interest, you're more likely to say, okay, you know what? If this is what gives me peace, we have the revenues, we don't disturb these people, it's fine, you know?
I mean, I agree. I often say this, and I don't know if it's controversial, hopefully it shouldn't be, which is that the military government, I mean, there was an elite consensus in Nigeria not to pay taxes between the military government and Nigerian elites.
Correct.
Don't tax us, we won't hold you accountable. Do whatever you want with the money, just don't tax us. Yeah. Just don't tax us. And the government was happy. The military government was happy with that. Okay, we won't tax you and we'll take the oil out of the ground and sell it and steal it, you know, whatever, right? And obviously now that needs to change because now there's not enough money from oil.
No, that has changed. And that's why, look, again, when you talk about property taxes, right? So a lot of work has gone in many places, right? First determining fair value of properties, how do you carry out those valuation exercises? How do you collect, how do you enumerate, you know, it's quite a bit of work, right? We've been at it now for a year and a half, you know, building, and that's
getting prepared to be able
and
to
that's actually even do. Building on the work of the predecessor government, right, who actually set up a GIS lab for the state. Now setting up that GIS lab again took us about a year and a half, right? So imagine we didn't have succession, right? A new government could
we'll
have come
and
in to
just
say,
dump it.
Hey, junk
and then
stuff.
10 years later, somebody will start from scratch again.
Exactly. You know, so
the
sometimes
continuity,
the continuity and the idea that we need to have a vision of whether it's Ekiti or Edo or Lagos or Ogun or Nasarawa first,
yeah.
as against political differentiators, yeah. it's a very tricky line, tricky. Right? So, because when you come into office and you're not from the same party as your predecessor, right? The odds are that you want to show, hey, you made a good choice in picking me.
Yeah.
So the fewer things you acknowledge that your predecessor got right, the better, right? So you then have this thing with unfinished projects.
Yeah, it's a problem.
So
yeah.
that's where I think on property taxes, I expect that over the next 2 to 3 years, you will see a significant jump, because not just in Ekiti, but in many states, there are a number of, for example, we're all part of a World Bank Business Environment Reform Program, which I find quite exciting, you know, which is also helping in ensuring that there's some standards in terms of how states enumerate and collect property taxes.
What role does communication play in all of this? Because I think you made a good point that if it's political, collecting taxes is political,
yep.
because collecting taxes is reminding people
yep.
that a government exists,
correct.
that should be providing services that they're not. So it's, if you collect it now, higher burden to deliver. And like, you know, we talked about the chicken and egg problem, mm-hmm. which is you need to actually collect something to have money to deliver.
Correct.
So how do you, what role does communication play to be able to communicate to people, this is what we're doing, this is why we're collecting the money, this is what we're doing with it, you know?
I'll give you an example in Ekiti, right? Before we started any work on property tax collection, right? And we haven't even started collecting, right? At this point, we're just about to issue notices. The governor has sat with multiple groups of stakeholders, traditional institutions, community development associations, right, local government associations across the state to explain why this is necessary. But we can only do that because we've shown what we've done with the resources we have today, right? We've shown, look, this is how much we pay out in salaries. This is how much we pay out in pensions. This is how much we owe in gratuity. This is how much of it we've been able to pay. These are the roads we're constructing. This is what we've done in education, in healthcare, in protecting the environment, in security, you know, in agriculture. So people actually know that, look, that, you know, you have to first feel the impact of government in some way,
yeah.
right? To be receptive to these things, right? But also in saying to them that, look, this is how it's done elsewhere, right? This is how it's been done in Brazil. This is how it's been done in South Africa. This is how it's been done in Lagos. This is how it's been done in FCT, right? And then when you think about the housing stock, I think the starting point is that 20 to 30% of the housing stock.
Housing stock, you mean for property taxes?
Yes, yeah. is actually owned by non-resident indigents, right? Who pay taxes wherever their primary domiciliation is, right? So there are people.
But they still have to pay property taxes on this property.
No, of course. But
yeah,
I'm saying
yeah,
that
yeah.
if I pay property taxes on a home in Lagos,
yeah.
then why should I complain about paying property taxes on a home in Ekiti?
Yeah.
Right? Yeah, I might say I want to pay less because I think it holds less economic value for me. That's an argument we can
have.
We can have, or a debate we can have, but you have to pay something.
How can the public and Nigerians in general help move this process along? What I mean is this, you know, we're talking about how, in my view, states have to drive development.
Mm-hmm.
What we all want as Nigerians is better public services. We want to open our taps and water run.
Correct.
We want the trash to be carried. We want the roads to be clear. All those things, in my view, a huge chunk of it is the states. We want to go to court and have our cases heard and have the person who killed somebody be prosecuted. Mm-hmm. Again, that's states. What role can Nigerians play in helping to create that accountability or creating a more virtuous cycle where people are held accountable and they deliver and people pay taxes? You know what I mean? Like,
so I think, look, you know what? I always worry about burdening individuals with more than their civic responsibility, right? So if you ask me, you know, individuals have two or three primary obligations. Pay your taxes, right? Let us know what you want in return, and vote us in or out on election day, right? You know, let's keep it simple, right? So let's not burden people with things that don't concern them, right? You know, that's fairly simple what I think the role of the individual is.
But I also think that there is a dearth of communication, right? Because a part of people understanding how to vote, where responsibility lies, is the public discourse, right? and not enough, and I don't know, it's not something that's, I hear, it's not just that not enough people in government, the state government, are talking about what they're doing and why. Mm-hmm. It's also that the public intellectuals are not talking about what the state should be doing and why, and what they shouldn't be doing. And like, I, you know, maybe this is my own, I you don't have to borrow it, but one of my answers to that question is that we need more public intellectuals debating and discussing policy ideas, what states should or shouldn't be doing, what actually is not their responsibility. You know what I mean? Like, in a clear-eyed way.
I think public intellectualism also responds to the interest of the public, right? Mm. Because in a way, by defining someone as a public intellectual, it means that they want to weigh and think about topics
that matter to the public.
Right? I think, but once you make a subnational, and because the subnationals are very different in makeup, in the level of development, etc., you know, there isn't a common brush with which you can solve all of those problems. So it then means you're speaking to smaller audiences, right? Or your messaging and your opinions, you know, are relatable to smaller audiences. Whereas there are major national issues, right, that everybody wants to talk about. So for example, everybody in Nigeria is a foreign exchange trader
right now,
right? So if you are a public intellectual who doesn't offer an opinion, whether you're sufficiently qualified to or not, it's a different conversation, but doesn't offer an opinion about security, about the exchange rate, etc.,
then you're not,
you know.
Yeah, well, I think, look, my own what I would offer is that I think that the leaders need to stimulate some of those conversations more. I don't know how, but I think there needs to be leadership in stimulating the conversations, not just about, I mean, it's better that we're even talking about exchange rate now. There was a time in Nigeria where for 2 years, all we talked about was Fulani headers.
But I'll tell you what.
Right?
So I'll tell you what. I think in some places, right, these conversations are happening, right? They might not be happening in a very frontline manner, right? So for example, quite a number of states, including ours, conduct a consultative budgeting exercise, right?
So I think we should be publicizing it more.
So at the beginning of, I mean, to be honest, yes, I hear you, but really our constituents are in Ekiti State.
And talk about it on TV.
Right? I mean, you know, that's neither here nor there, right? So that's showbiz, in my opinion, right? Because the people we want to engage with, we are engaging with, right? So we go around senatorial districts before a budget cycle starts, and we say to the people, we're about to cut a budget.
Yeah.
What are your biggest needs? And I'll tell you what, when I started this thing, I'll be honest enough to say, I didn't quite believe in the wisdom of the crowds, right? But as I participated in the process in Ekiti, I found that people were very thoughtful and very perceptive about what they wanted.
Just average citizens.
Pretty much, you know, not, I mean, leaders, you like don't, you can't listen leaders to 200 people,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
But people who are nominated to speak on behalf of the communities, they actually spoke quite well.
Yeah.
And some of the things that they asked us to do were so clever, they made it into the budget, right?
Okay.
So that helps in saying, look, you can also shape the future you want to see as people. Now, once people start to see those outcomes, they start to think more deeply, right, about what they want to ask for, right? Because they now start asking, why does Mr. A's request get, why does it get included?
And mine doesn't.
You know, and maybe it's the quality of what we're asking for, right? So I think that way, you know, that kind of comes very, it's very localized, right? But that kind of communication style actually helps people see results. And of course, at the end of the day, the beauty of this thing is seeing the thing delivered and seeing it deliver the goals that the people expected.
So I want to end on, because we're starting to run out of time, I want to end on this issue of viability of the states. And there are a few different angles to it. One is just, you know, I think you've made the point earlier that I want to pick up, that a part of what state governments need to do is figure out how to invest in a way that actually allows them to generate more income. Like, you have to invest in productivity so that you can tax,
correct,
right? There's some debate that there are some states that are just not viable.
Okay.
Do you agree, what's your view on that? Do you think that's, you know, because you have to have a certain base to even have enough even be able to invest in productivity, right?
Yeah.
Like, do you think that every state in Nigeria is viable?
I'll interrupt you there. I think that's a lazy argument.
Okay.
Right, and I think it's lazy because first, there isn't much you can do about that.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So you've already created 36 of them.
Yeah.
Right? So it's like having a child and saying, I don't think this child is like, I mean, if you knew, why did you have the child? So you have the child. You know, you have the state.
You've got to figure out how to make it work.
You've got to make it work. Yeah. So that's the first thing.
That's right.
I don't think there's any state in Nigeria, in terms of population, etc., that is smaller than the smallest country on the continent. Right? So when you think about the sheer population of Nigerians and how distributed those people are, Bayelsa, Ekiti, you know, where 3.5 million people were, pretty much in the smallest bracket, right?
Yeah.
We're bigger than, you know, 13, 14 countries on the continent, right? You don't tell Botswana or Malawi and say, you know, shut this place up, it's not viable, right? So I think it's a lazy argument. I think the conversation should not be about whether a state is viable or not. It's about how do we optimize that, right?
Right.
How do we create a sense of, first, some baseline equality, so create a floor, and say we want to get everybody to this floor.
That floor.
Now, what you do above that floor is your problem, right? But as a federation,
right,
we want to get you to this floor.
So that's, I want to talk about that, because sometimes that's controversial in Nigeria.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that, you know, some people think every state should have...
To thy tent, O Israel.
Yeah. What did he say? Yeah, exactly. This idea that, like, the federal government shouldn't redistribute resources. Mm-hmm. If oil is producing, if there's oil revenue from, you know, river states, mm-hmm, it should be only for rivers, and every state should be. And I find that problematic, and I want, because you can't develop a country without, like you said, having a flow. You can't just leave some parts of the country behind. You know, it's sort of like, because what happens when you, it's, I say South Africa is like Middle Europe with Ajegunle combined, mm-hmm, in one place, and it causes them a lot of problems, because what you're going to have is the politics of Ajegunle will draw everybody down.
Of course.
Right? So it just, you have to bring everybody along, otherwise those poor impoverished people will end up pulling everybody back.
I think we should not even debate this. These are not hypotheticals, right? These are things that we've seen real time happen.
Yeah.
I mean, the Lagos State governor from Sanwo-Olu to Ambode to Fashola, and even to Mr. President now, Asiwaju, you know, at some time would have complained about, hey, you know, we have an influx of people coming into Lagos, we have a resource challenge in dealing with these numbers, etc. People will always migrate to where they see opportunities, right? The best way to keep people where they are is to create opportunities there.
Everywhere.
So you've got to create opportunities everywhere and create that floor where people think we have a chance at a decent quality of life and we don't have to leave, you know, to do that. So I think it's a myopic view.
So you're saying that the federal government has to redistribute resources in a way to try to
it's a balance. So again,
even out, create a flow of equality.
Yeah, there are two things. You're trying to ensure there's some baseline equality, but you're also reflecting that those who generate the resources get a fair share of those resources. Now, what is that fair share? You know, it's 13% derivation. You know, tomorrow it could be 20. You know, it could be, you know, whatever that number is, right?
Yeah.
But the reality is that everybody is seeing it, right? A lot of the security problems that we have in my state, they don't originate in Ekiti, right? They originate in neighboring states.
Mm.
And if those states are unable to curb the problems, they don't come into Ekiti.
So it's in your interest.
So it's in our interest.
That there is a central government that can also make sure that there's development happening there.
Exactly.
Otherwise, it's going to impact in negative.
Because as we continue on our development trajectory, and if we're very successful at it, we're only going to, it's like living in a house in the middle of a slum, right, and living in this great house and not expecting to get robbed every day.
Okay, well, that's a good place to end. Thank you for being on the podcast. Great conversation, and hopefully we'll have you back. And thank you.
Thank you.